The Synthesis of Yoga, Sri Aurobindo. Continuing with Part 1, The Yoga of Divine Works, Chapter 5, The Ascent of Sacrifice, Number 1, on page 139. It is natural, from the point of view of the yoga, to divide into two categories the activities of the human mind in its pursuit of knowledge. There is the supreme supra-intellectual knowledge, which concentrates itself on the discovery of the One and Infinite in its transcendence, or tries to penetrate by intuition, contemplation, direct inner contact into the ultimate truths behind the appearances of nature. There is the lower science, which diffuses itself in an outward knowledge of phenomena, the disguises of the One and Infinite, as it appears to us in or through the more exterior forms of the world manifestation around us. These two, an upper and a lower hemisphere, in the form of them constructed or conceived by men within the mind's ignorant limits, have even there separated themselves as they developed, with some sharpness. Philosophy, sometimes spiritual, or at least intuitive, sometimes abstract and intellectual, sometimes intellectualizing spiritual experience, or supporting with a logical apparatus the discoveries of the spirit, has claimed always to take the fixation of ultimate truth as its province. But even when it did not separate itself on rarefied metaphysical heights from the knowledge that belongs to the practical world and the pursuit of ephemeral objects, intellectual philosophy, by its habit of abstraction, has seldom been a power for life. It has been sometimes powerful for high speculation, pursuing mental truth for its own sake without any ulterior utility or object, sometimes for a subtle gymnastic of the mind in a mistily bright cloudland of words and ideas. But it has walked or acrobatized far from the more tangible realities of existence. Ancient philosophy in Europe was more dynamic, but only for the few. In India, in its more spiritualized forms, it strongly influenced, but without transforming the life of the race. Religion did not attempt, like philosophy, to live alone on the heights. Its aim was rather to take hold of man's parts of life even more than his parts of mind and draw them Godwards. It professed to build a bridge between spiritual truth and the vital and material human existence. It strove to subordinate and reconcile the lower to the higher, make life serviceable to God, earth obedient to heaven. It has to be admitted that too often this necessary effort had the opposite result of making heaven a sanction for earth's desires. For continually, the religious idea has been turned into an excuse for the worship and service of the human ego. Religion, leaving constantly its little shining core of spiritual experience, has lost itself in the obscure mass of its ever-extending, ambiguous compromises with life, in attempting to satisfy the thinking mind, it more often succeeded in oppressing or fettering it with a mass of theological dogmas. While seeking to net the human heart, it fell itself into pits of pietistic emotionalism and sensationalism. In the act of annexing the vital nature of man to dominate it, it grew itself vitiated and fell a prey to all the fanaticism, homicidal fury, savage, or harsh turn for oppression, pullulating falsehood, obstinate attachment to ignorance to which that vital nature is prone. Its desire to draw the physical in man towards God betrayed it into chaining itself to ecclesiastic mechanism, hollow ceremony, and lifeless ritual. The corruption of the best produced the worst by that strange chemistry of the power of life, which generates evil out of good, even as it can also generate good out of evil. At the same time, in a vain effort at self-defense against this downward gravitation, religion was driven to cut existence into two by a division of knowledge, works, art, life itself, into two opposite categories, the spiritual and the worldly, religious and mundane, sacred and profane. But this defensive distinction itself became conventional and artificial and aggravated rather than healed the disease. On their side, science and art and the knowledge of life, although at first they served or lived in the shadow of religion, ended by emancipating themselves, became estranged or hostile, or have even recoiled with indifference, contempt, or skepticism from what seemed to them the cold, barren, and distant, or unsubstantial and illusory heights of unreality to which metaphysical philosophy and religion aspire. For a time, the divorce has been as complete as the one-sided intolerance of the human mind could make it, and threatened even to end in a complete extinction of all attempt at a higher or a more spiritual knowledge. Yet even in the earthward life, a higher knowledge is indeed the one thing that is throughout needful. And without it, the lower sciences and pursuits, however fruitful, however rich, free, miraculous in the abundance of their results, become easily a sacrifice offered without due order and to false gods, corrupting, hardening in the end the heart of man, limiting his mind's horizons. They confine in a stony material imprisonment or lead to a final baffling incertitude and disillusionment. A sterile agnosticism awaits us above the brilliant phosphorescence of a half-knowledge that is still the ignorance. A yoga turned towards an all-embracing realization of the Supreme will not despise the works, or even the dreams, if dreams they are, of the cosmic spirit, or shrink from the splendid toil and many-sided victory which he has assigned to himself in the human creature. But its first condition for this liberality is that our works in the world, too, must be part of the sacrifice offered to the highest and to none else, to the divine Shakti, and to no other power, in the right spirit and with the right knowledge, by the free soul, and not by the hypnotized bondslave of material nature. If a division of works has to be made, it is between those that are nearest to the heart of the sacred flame and those that are least touched or illumined by it, because they are more at a distance, or between the fuel that burns strongly and brightly and the logs that, if too thickly heaped on the altar, may impede the ardor of the fire by their rather damp, heavy, and diffused abundance. But otherwise, apart from this division, all activities of knowledge that seek after or express truth are, in themselves, rightful materials for a complete offering. None ought necessarily to be excluded from the wide framework of the divine life. the mental and physical sciences, which examine into the laws and forms and processes of things, those which concern the life of men and animals, the social, political, linguistic, and historical, and those which seek to know and control the labors and activities by which man subdues and utilizes his world and environment, and the noble and beautiful arts, which are at once work and knowledge. For every well-made and significant poem, picture, statue, or building is an act of creative knowledge, a living discovery of the consciousness, a figure of truth, a dynamic form of mental and vital self-expression or world expression, all that seeks, all that finds, all that voices or figures is a realization of something of the play of the infinite, and to that extent can be made a means of God realization or of divine formation. But the yogin has to see that it is no longer done as part of an ignorant mental life. It can be accepted by him only if by the feeling, the remembrance, the dedication within it, it is turned into a movement of the spiritual consciousness and becomes a part of its vast grasp of comprehensive, illuminating knowledge. For all must be done as a sacrifice. All activities must have the one divine for their object and the heart of their meaning. The yogin's aim in the sciences that make for knowledge should be to discover and understand the workings of the divine consciousness puissance in man and creatures and things and forces, her creative significances, her execution of the mysteries, the symbols in which she arranges the manifestation. The yogin's aim in the practical sciences, whether mental and physical or occult and psychic, should be to enter into the ways of the divine and his processes, to know the materials and means for the work given to us so that we may use that knowledge for a conscious and faultless expression of the spirit's mastery, joy, and self-fulfillment. The yogin's aim in the arts should not be a mere aesthetic, mental, or vital gratification, but seeing the divine everywhere, worshipping it with a revelation of the meaning of its own works, to express that one divine in ideal forms, the one divine in principles and forces, the one divine in gods and men and creatures and objects. The theory that sees an intimate connection between religious aspiration and the truest and greatest art is, in essence, right. But we must substitute for the mixed and doubtful religious motive a spiritual aspiration, vision, interpreting experience. For the wider and more comprehensive the seeing, the more it contains in itself the sense of the hidden divine in humanity and in all things, and rises beyond a superficial religiosity into the spiritual life, the more luminous, flexible, deep, and powerful will the art be that springs from that high motive. The yogin's distinction from other men is this, that he lives in a higher and vaster spiritual consciousness. All his work of knowledge or creation must then spring from there. It must not be made in the mind, for it is a greater truth and vision than mental man's that he has to express, or rather that presses to express itself through him and mold his works, not for his personal satisfaction, but for a divine purpose. At the same time, the yogin who knows the Supreme is not subject to any need or compulsion in these activities. For to him they are neither a duty nor a necessary occupation for the mind, nor a high amusement, nor imposed even by the loftiest human purpose. He is not attached, bound, and limited by any, nor has he any personal motive of fame, greatness, or personal satisfaction in these works. He can leave or pursue them as the divine in him wills, but he need not otherwise abandon them in his pursuit of the higher integral knowledge. He will do these things just as the Supreme Power acts and creates, for a certain spiritual joy in creation and expression, or to help in the holding together and right ordering or leading of this world of God's workings. The Gita teaches that the man of knowledge shall, by his way of life, give to those who have not yet the spiritual consciousness, the love and habit of all works, and not only of actions recognized as pious, religious, or ascetic in their character. He should not draw men away from the world action by his example. For the world must proceed in its great upward aspiring. Men and nations must not be led to fall away from even an ignorant activity into a worse ignorance of inaction, or to sink down into that miserable disintegration and tendency of dissolution which comes upon communities and peoples when there predominates the tamasic principle, the principle whether of obscure confusion and error or of weariness and inertia. For I too, says the Lord in the Gita, have no need to do works, since there is nothing I have not or must yet gain for myself. Yet I do works in the world. For if I did not do works, all laws would fall into confusion, the worlds would sink towards chaos, and I would be the destroyer of these peoples. The spiritual life does not need, for its purity, to destroy interest in all things except the inexpressible, or to cut at the roots of the sciences, the arts, and life. It may well be one of the effects of an integral spiritual knowledge and activity to lift them out of their limitations, substitute for our minds ignorant, limited, tepid, or trepidant pleasure in them, a free, intense, and uplifting urge of delight, and supply a new source of creative spiritual power and illumination by which they can be carried more swiftly and profoundly towards their absolute light in knowledge and their yet undreamed possibilities and most dynamic energy of content and form and practice. The one thing needful must be pursued first and always, but all things else come with it as its outcome, and have not so much to be added to us as recovered and reshaped in its self-light and as portions of its self-expressive force. Stopping here, mid-page 144.